Welcome to Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Our website is econtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives, where you can listen to every episode we've ever done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail at econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is October 23rd, 2020, and my guest is economist Emily Oster of Brown University. This is Emily's fourth appearance on Econ Talk. Her last time here was April of 2019 to talk about her most recent book, Crib Sheet, her data-driven guide to parenting. Today, we're going to talk about work that she has been doing on the pandemic, particularly what we've learned about the vulnerability of school children. And if we have time, we'll also revisit some of Emily's work on pregnancy and parenting. Emily, welcome back to Econ Talk.
Thank you for having me. I always like to get to chat with you.
So describe the nature of the data that you've been gathering, where it's coming from, and what you've learned so far.
Yeah, so we've been gathering data on schools, and the approach that we're taking is to basically start with schools and school districts. So we would like to do some, the sort of ultimate goal is to do some tracking of COVID cases in schools and of how outbreaks or cases are affected by mitigation practices. But we realized to do that, we kind of needed to understand what the situation is at the school first. So what we do is we go out to districts or individual schools, we ask them to enroll and give us a bunch of information on how many kids they have in person, are they opening in person, how many staff do they have, and then are they masking and distancing at various distances. And then once we get that, then we come back to them every other week and ask them how many COVID cases they have. And the data then goes into a public dashboard, which is identified not at the school or district level, but at broader geographic levels, with the idea that people can, you look at it, get a general sense of what's going on, get a sense of kind of filtering a little bit by the things people are doing, looking at different age groups. As we get more data, I hope we'll be able to say some more things about kind of what looks like it's working, what's the details of the relationship between the community spread and the school spread. But that's the basic structure of this data project.
And you say we, who's we?
So we is me, and then also a team from Qualtrics, which is a technology data survey company, and a bunch of school-related people. So in particular, the Association of School Superintendents, the national one, and then we've gotten help from a bunch of the state associations, the National Association of Principals, elementary and secondary principals, that's two different groups, and then a bunch of private school associations. So basically a bunch of people who have school affiliations plus the kind of Qualtrics data side.
And is this a for-profit venture?
No. Oh my goodness. It is not a for-profit venture. No, this is basically entirely, at the moment, basically almost entirely volunteer effort that has some funding now from Chan Zuckerberg and a few other foundations, Templeton, something called Silver Giving. So we've gotten a little bit of foundation funding, but it is largely run in a volunteer way.
And how many schools, districts, students are you capturing right now?
So in the most recent poll of the sort of most recent 2-week period that we're looking at, there are about 1,300 schools, about 700,000 total enrolled students, of whom about 280,000 are in person, about 80,000 in-person staff. So, you know, it's still relatively small, I think, you know, given that there are 56 million kids in school. We do have reasonably good geographic coverage in the sense we do have some data from every state. And I think we will, in the next period, have much more because states have started doing a better job doing report outs of some of this information on their own. And we can probably pull that in and that will increase our sample quite a lot.
So I have no children in K through 12 anymore. Our friends who have children K through 12, typically when I ask them, how are your kids doing? They say, oh, they spend 45 minutes a week in face-to-face and then they're not allowed to learn anything. They're just doing, I don't know what they're doing, and they have to alternate. There's all this crazy stuff going on. Yeah. Are there, of those, how many kids did you say in this? 780,000?
Yeah, I have 700,000. Yeah, something like 750,000, I think.
And 280,000, you said, were in person.
Yeah.
Are they in person 24/7? I mean, not 24/7, but all every day.
I wish. Yeah. No, they unfortunately, if you want to offer that.
Well, they'd be so smart. Yeah. Oh, my God.
I know, right?
Are they, so when you say they're in person, are they in person sometime during the week or full time?
It varies. So about in our data, about a quarter. So it's something like those numbers are estimated in that number 280,000, like estimated in person daily attendance. So that's a sort of like, so that's actually understating the number of kids who are in person, because if the school is like a hybrid, you know, people are there half the time, that gets registered as like half the kids. So actually we're seeing, you know, in the data, I think about a quarter of the schools are just fully remote. About a quarter of them are full-time in person for everybody. And the 50% are some hybrid, in which some kids are there in different at different times.
And so, is that sample going to expand or is this kind of it?
No, I think the sample will expand. I mean, I think the next big kind of push on this is to try to get states to sort of more broadly partner with us to do this. So there hasn't actually been that much. So some states are doing quite good report out. Other states are doing less good report out. We are planning to work in something where districts that are enrolled can have basically their own district specific dashboard, which would be private to them, where they could see what's going on with their schools and see some benchmarks. So we're kind of hoping to fold that kind of service into this, in the sense that then it will help places and then encourage them to be part of it. So we're trying to grow.
And when did it start? Before we're about to get into the interesting stuff, folks listening at home, but going to get these preliminaries out of the way so you know what we're dealing with. When did it start?
August. So basically, August. We started doing this in August, and we posted the first kind of round of data, which covers basically the first 2 weeks of September, posted in kind of the towards the end of September. And then we've done sort of these biweekly polls. We're about to start next week. We'll pull the fourth round of biweekly data.
And what have you found so far?
So I think what we found, there's sort of a few things to highlight. So the first thing, the kind of headline thing, is that we've talked about, is that the risks seem to be relatively low. So at least, you know, in the places that we're seeing, it's about, we're seeing in this most recent period about 1.5 cases per 1,000 kids per 2 week period, about twice that in staff. So higher rates in staff than in students. That's actually, although our sample is fairly selected, so I think it's a little tricky to sort of say, okay, that's the number. I mean, I would not say that's the number for everybody. It's actually pretty in line with a lot of other numbers that are kind of coming out in various ways. So, you know, relatively limited risks, but more than that, risks that really are in line with what's going on in the community. And that's probably the most salient feature, is that what we're seeing sort of looks like if they're spread in the community, you get cases in schools, but we aren't seeing a lot of what looks like big outbreaks in the schools. And you know, and we are seeing these rates scale with the community. And that's true, like, so for example, we have a bunch of schools in pretty high prevalence areas where students are not in person and staff are. So the staff are like coming in to work. I don't know why we have that. It's not actually, there's not a lot of reason to think that would be a great model from a public health standpoint, but at any rate, that's a model places have. In those places, we're seeing rates in staff that are very similar to the rates that we're seeing in places where the students are in person.
So the worry when schools went back into session was twofold, I'd say maybe threefold, that students aren't going to be good at masks, they're not going to be good at social distancing, whether you have rules or not, they're going to get violated either in the classroom, on the playground, in the cafeteria, and then staff members, particularly older staff members, will be at risk because they'll have encounters in various, even though they'll be doing their best to socially distance, they'll get in trouble, or parents will, because this gathering of students, and we get this word, this scary word, super spreader.
Super spreader.
Which sounds like super soaker to me, which sounds horrible. It's got saliva in it and it's yucky. But you're not finding that so far.
No, we're not seeing that so far. And I think that we're not seeing, you know, I think we're not seeing that in our data. We're not seeing in other data either. So, you know, I think this came up, this issue of like sort of schools as the origin of outbreaks was something people talked a lot about when the schools first started to open in August. You know, there was this like, okay, these Georgia is going to open their high schools and kind of this is going to be like the waves are going to follow this. And we haven't really seen that. We've seen it for colleges. So I think in part, it's not like we don't see that for any educational institutions. So there are places where colleges open and you can see that the rates in the area are just like skyrocketing as a result of what seems pretty clearly to be college reopenings. But we're just not seeing the same thing for kind of K-12 openings. And again, not in our data and not in other data either.
Let's say you need a dummy variable for beer. It's not as much beer in K through 12 as there is in college.
It actually is. I mean, we can talk more about this exactly about our data, but there is this sort of interesting question of like, you know, if you think that the K-12 numbers, in particular, the fact that high schools, although the high schools are higher risk than elementary schools, which is something we see very clearly in our data and see elsewhere too, that like the elementary schools are particularly low risk and the high schools are slightly higher risk, but they're not looking anything like the colleges. And I think that's a bit puzzling because my experience is that, you know, there are high school parties with beer as well. The colleges, it may be some combination of the beer and the living together.
But I think presumably it's also just the biological nature of the virus that we don't fully understand that, you know, people have suggested that especially younger children, not high school, but K through six, just don't have the susceptibility to it and aren't spreading it, period. That's what has been suggested.
Yeah, no, and I think that a lot of that is clearly going on for younger kids and for the elementary school kids. And high school students are going to be on average a bit less risky than college students if we think it's sort of scaling with age, but it's still, they're not that different in terms of age. I don't think that's a bit of a puzzling aspect.
I think part of the reason people were afraid is that, you know, early on, certain countries became, I don't know, symbolic of some hypothesis. So Israel had a outbreak early on, and then they had a very serious lockdown where actually I would use the word lockdown, where you had to stay in your you're in your space, and there were serious consequences if you were caught violating going outside. So they knocked their case though down to quote zero, very close to zero. Then they thought, oh, we won, we did this, and they reopened. And my impression, and I'm curious if you know, my impression was that and they've since had a very bad outbreak, a so-called second surge, that school openings played a role in that. And I don't know if that's true, if we know that's true, but that was the received wisdom early on.
Yeah. So that is a received wisdom. And I think what is very interesting about and sort of unfortunate is that the Israel really, it does seem to be different than elsewhere on this dimension in a way that I think is not that well understood. So actually many countries in Europe, Israel's not really in Europe, but many countries outside the US open schools, kept schools open them in the summer, have them open now. And we're seeing the same kinds of evidence out of those places that we're seeing from the US that, you know, we're not seeing that they're driving community spread. There's like a nice paper about Germany where they use variations in the end of the summer holidays. This just came out last week to look at whether kids are more likely to be infected after they go back to school. And actually, if anything, like the rates in kids go down after school entry, because I think that the summer vacation was a high risk thing.
Yeah.
We see sort of a similar thing in Spain. We see this stuff in the UK. It's like all of that stuff is kind of pretty reassuring. But Israel is definitely more of an outlier. And there was this initial art thing about like basically there was a bunch of spread in there was like a sort of, I think there was a super spreader event in a high school. And then they have sort of subsequently, even like today, something came out suggesting that they had like actually a relatively high share of cases in kids, very different than what we're seeing in a lot of other places. So I think it's, I don't think we understand that well. It definitely seems like their experience with school and with kids in general has been quite different. And it's hard to separate because, of course, when they kind of released their lockdown a little bit and opened schools, they also allowed like 400-person weddings. And when they opened the schools, they were just totally open, no de-densification, like 40 kids in a classroom, you know, no masks, or at least there was a period of masks, but then it got really hot. They stopped having masks. So it wasn't exactly best practices, but it is definitely outside of what we have seen elsewhere.
That's always good to remember. There's more than one variable. Hard to remember sometimes in this, particularly in this conversation about pandemic that we're having, the pandemic we're having in the country. People tend to pick their favorite variable and then explain why it's the only variable, and they're wrong usually. So let's talk about why this is important. One of the things that's deeply – there's a number of things that are deeply disturbing to me about where we are with our knowledge of the pandemic. This issue of saving lives, which we're all in favor of, we seem to have neglected the non-life-saving costs of any kind of intervention. So one of the costs, obviously, of out-of-person school or even a hybrid model is seems to be a lot less learning going on, particularly for poorer children in poorer neighborhoods. A lot of wealthier people and more comfortable, economically comfortable people are doing pod sharing and creating little mini schools and doing in-person tutoring and teaching. And we're just kind of like hoping it'll go away soon so that we can get back to normal. But in the meanwhile, there's millions of kids who are going to have a wasted year. Or is it? Am I overreacting?
No, I don't think you're overreacting. I mean, I've found, I sort of oscillate between like frustration and being tired and then just being really like angry that we've somehow gotten to a place where even though it seems like schools are a fairly low risk thing, and in my mind, these schools are school is really beneficial. I mean, maybe other people don't think that, but I think in-person schooling is really important. And somehow we've gotten to a place where we're kind of putting that last. The other day, like Massachusetts is having more cases, still in pretty good shape, but they're having more cases. Boston has very little in-person schooling. They had like a younger kids with special needs were the only group that was back. And in response to a rising caseload, effectively the only change that they made was to tell those kids they can no longer come to school, even though there was no evidence of any spread in having anything to do with this. And restaurants are open and bars are open and gyms are open. And like the idea that somehow like that's the first thing to go. Like if you think you're having some cases, let's just shut down schools because like, you know, just that's not... Just in case, even though we didn't see any cases there, let's just shut them down in case. I think it's really bad. And I think it totally misses exactly as you say that there are these very large costs we will be experiencing in the long term and some very large costs in the short term in terms of, you know, mental health and food insecurity and, you know, kids who are in kind of not great environments even for kids who are in better environments, like the relationship with their parents. You know, this is really hard on families, even families with resources. And there's a lot of inequities. There's a lot of socioeconomic inequities. So in places like in San Francisco, they've said basically no public schools will be open until at a minimum January, which doesn't make any sense because they have almost no cases. But the private schools are all open. So all the kids who are in private school are going in full time, full day. And then, you know, the kid lower and people with fewer resources are not going to school at all. And there's geographic inequity.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, you know, and geographic inequity that makes no sense. Like all the, you know, there are all these kids in North Dakota. North Dakota, a lot of places still full-time, 5 days a week, everybody at school, even though they have like really a very significant outbreak. While at the same time, you know, San Francisco, LA, Boston are totally closed.
Well, it's good for you. You get some good data from that kind of behavior.
It's interesting. You know, it's like as an economist, you generally you would expect that when you try to do this kind of data collection, the obvious bias would be the only places that would open would be places where the virus is under control. So you'd be like, well, how can I learn about, you know? But actually, it's the opposite. The places that are open are the places with like a tremendous amount of virus. So that was
I talked to a friend yesterday. He's a freelancer, and I asked him how his work was going. He said, well, I work about 7 seconds a day. I said, what are you doing the rest of the time? He goes, I'm trying to keep my kids safe, happy, doing something mildly productive, shuttling them somewhere that's helpful. So it's taking a toll on parents, obviously. But let me give you the – I'm going to give you the other side and let you react to it. So I'm on your side. But that's easy for me to say. I don't have any kids. And so it's easy for me to opine on this. So for people who are, you know, let me take the more cautious side. The more cautious side goes something like this. You know, you're talking about how great it would be. We should reopen schools. Well, first of all, we don't know anything about the long-term impact of this. So it's true that it's really rare that young kids get this, but if they do get it, it could impair them for a long time going forward. Second thing is they could get their grandparents sick and kill them even though they're not symptomatic themselves or have a bad case themselves. They could get through it quickly, but in families that have multi-generational living situations, these kids are literally dangerous to their loved ones. And so this is totally rational. It's crucial that we save these lives. And what's the big deal? So they're learning online. It's not that big a deal. What's your response? Do you agree with that?
I don't. But I mean, I do agree with is I think that sort of inherent in what you say is the idea that people are going to make different choices about this. And so that, you know, a policy which said all children must be in school no matter what, and you know, families will have no choice about whether their kids go to school. I think that's probably not in this sort of, I think that may not be a policy we want to have right now. There are actually places in Europe do have that policy, but I think almost like basically every school district that's open in person in the current environment in the US has offered choice for people who want to do some kind of distance learning. And so, and I actually spent a lot of the like first part of the pandemic before I started doing this school stuff, talking to people about how they could make, like think through those choices for themselves and, you know, how you would trade off exactly this kind of like grandparents versus versus schools. And I think that trade-off, that has been the hardest trade-off for parents in my kind of like age bracket, where it's sort of like when I choose to send my kids to school, that has pretty significant implications for how I like my ability to see their grandparents.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, that means they're higher risk and then, you know, the grandparents are higher risk. And that I think people are going to differ in how they evaluate that trade-off. What I thought you were going to say, and I think the argument I see much more is, you know, we're sort of forcing teachers into this, that this is not, you know, and because I think it's one thing, it's easy to say, let's give parents a choice, but, you know, it's harder to give teachers a choice. That's their job. And, you know, you can not work or so on, but, you know, to pretty sort tough. Of say you have to, it's hard. And I, you know, and I think that, that's a harder, I think the best thing we can say there is really that like when schools choose to open, they should, you know, they should be providing teachers with, like they should provide kids with masks. They should provide teachers with masks. You know, there should be like, to the extent possible, they should put in these kind of protections. But I think the other thing to say is that, you know, what we're seeing in the data does suggest that for the most part, when teachers are getting sick, they're getting sick outside of school, and not in school. And so it's not clear that it doesn't seem obvious that school is an especially high risk location.
So I'm going to, I have to say this carefully. I don't know if it's easy. I can't. I don't know how to say it carefully. I'm just going to say it. So, I had a toothache back in April. I just hoped it would go away. It didn't go away. The reason I hoped it go away is that I didn't want to go to see my dentist to look at it. The idea of going out and being in close proximity as someone who was seeing other people, you know, numerous times a day didn't seem very fun. But about a week and a half ago, I went in and had my tooth pulled, which is, by the way, anyone listening at home?
My God.
It's
this is like months and months and months of this that you needed.
Just, I'm against it. Try to keep your teeth. I'm a big fan of keeping my teeth. But I'm glad it's gone. It was not really pleasant. But I thanked all the people in the office. You know, my dentist said to me, this is the least COVID risk place in the world. You know, he's got a mask and then he's got a plastic face shield and you get your temperature taken when you walk in. But the truth is, You're not spitting in a cup for a test when you get there. They don't know who you've been seeing and where you've been. And you could be very asymptomatic and still be troublesome. But the truth is, I mean, I'm violating all the things I try to avoid. Yeah. You know, I'm a foot and a half away from somebody for 20 minutes or a half an hour. So it's really unpleasant. But he's doing that every day with every person who comes in there. And I thanked him. And I said, it's really, I really appreciate it. And I think a lot of people in the medical professions and dentists and others, all kinds of people up and down the line, grocery stores and so on, yes, they like money. Yes, they feel that it's good for them to work. But I think they also feel like they're supposed to be there. That's the feeling I get from the doctors I've seen in the last 6 months and the dentists and all the people do it. You know, it's sort of like, I mean, it's again, easy for me to say my job involves sitting in my home and recording podcasts and other solitary things. But it's interesting to me that teachers who work with children do not either feel that obligation or we do not encourage them to feel that obligation. Do you think that's a fair assessment of this issue?
I think there are pieces that are fair and then pieces where it's more complicated. So, you know, when we asked, people have drawn this parallel with nurses and doctors, said, you know, well, look, we required them to go to work during the pandemic, and, you know, because that was their job.
Some of them died too, by the way.
And you know, some of them
pretty,
died.
Pretty harsh.
It was actually quite high risk. But of course, then people have pointed out that, you know, they're provided with more PPE than we were providing teachers with, you know, although it is a much higher risk environment to be in a medical office treating people with COVID than to be in a school. But one of the things I think is going on in a lot of these cases, and I think we could learn something from the sort of experience of this, like, kind of medical space, is that the sort of ripping off the Band-Aid of going back is that step is hard. And I think it's really scary. Yeah. And actually, when I talked to, like, my friend, you know, one of my friends is an ED, like a pediatric ED doc. And she said, you know, she was on vacation when the pandemic started, and then she had to come back. The first, you know, few days were really scary because it was like, I was just all walking around all the time thinking, like, at any moment I could get COVID. And of course, at that point, it was like really unclear exactly what was going on. But she said, you know, then kind of like I got used to it and we figured out the procedures and we figured out, you know, even though it looks a little different, it was like okay. And I think that when schools have gone back, that many teachers have had that experience. I think, I mean, my kids are back in school and their teachers at the beginning were like, I don't know, how is it going to be? And now they're like, oh yeah, it's like, it's actually great. They're, you know, it's so great to be with the kids. It's like, they're sort of, you're experiencing like the good pieces of it. But I do think we didn't, you know, even putting aside the approach of individual teachers or of the unions, we kind of haven't, we didn't think about this as essential in a way that I think we, you know, we said, okay, grocery stores are essential, but somehow we never said schools are essential. And that, I think, has shaped the discussion a lot.
You know, I think the tearing off the Band-Aid thing and then to getting used to it, there's a little bit of an illusion there. I've noticed among some of my friends that my analogy is, you know, the guy, he's given 121 dollar bills and he's in a payment for something and he starts counting them 1, 2, 3, 4. And after he gets 46, 47, he goes, yeah, I don't know. If it's right this far, it's probably right the rest of the way. And he stops counting. A lot of people, I feel like, have said, like, well, I haven't gotten it yet. So I think I'm safe.
I'm and probably it's not going to get it.
It's not true. And they start, I see them change their behavior.
Pandemic fatigue.
They start,
I believe
exactly.
That's the way it's like, pandemic fatigue.
And they start doing riskier things. But I guess the other way to look at this, let's put on our political economy hats. You know, my free market oriented friends say, this school problem is exactly what's wrong with the teachers unions. They don't want it to go back and they're protecting their employees. Others would say, well, that's their job. That's exactly why we need unions, is to protect them from this. I guess the other thing to think about is it does kind of suggest that maybe we don't value our school so much. It's like, you know, I tell the joke, I've told this on Econ Talk before, of the teacher I was talking to on the airplane about, you know, what she was a math teacher. I said, you know, what's fourth grade like, or sixth grade, whatever it was, at your school? She said, well, it's kind of a review year. I thought, a review year? That seems like a strange, low set of expectations. So maybe we just don't expect much from the school part of our lives, and maybe we're going to learn something from this. Maybe we'll learn that it isn't so bad.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure, you know, I think we are not as a society, we do not prioritize schools in general, and we certainly have not prioritized them here. And, you know, the other thing people keep saying is like, well, you know, parents are out there expecting schools to be childcare, and, you know, schools are not childcare, and, you know, that's not a reasonable expectation. But of course, like, we've set up a society in which school is your childcare. It's the state literally requires you to send your children to this childcare. So it's a little bit funny to say that, you know, somehow families should be able to just like replace that with something else, given that we've sort of set up a society with that in mind.
So let's look at the bigger picture. I've been deeply disturbed in the last month as we get closer to the election at how difficult it is to have a thoughtful conversation about COVID generally and what we might learn from this. And I feel that anything you say about COVID, and I'm curious if this has been your experience, because you've been out, I'm on Twitter
talking about it.
You're actually writing articles in The Atlantic saying, that we'll link to, saying, you know, I think we should go back to school. This isn't so bad. Yeah. Which means, obviously, you know, you're on a certain team with a certain color, partisan flavor, and shame on you. And so I've been – at any time you say anything, it's taken as that you're either pro or anti a particular political position. I find that horrifying for so many reasons. But one of them is, if you can't share opinions about this and then you can't discuss it because you can't share an opinion – really hard to learn stuff. And all the people that I've noticed who are somewhat contrarian, who aren't political, but have been accused of being political pawns, you know, they're being silenced literally because they're obviously wrong. That really bothers me. Would you react to that? And especially somebody who works in this space of using data to try to figure out risk and you know, safety and what we can learn from it.
Yeah. I mean, I have been really, it has been very difficult to have these conversations and try to make them be about data when, you know, as soon as you say like, okay, more schools should be open, it's like, oh, like you're like Donald Trump. Yeah, are you on exactly. Donald Trump? You on Donald Trump's team? I was like, you know, no. And in fact, like, I actually think that the cause of school reopening was tremendously damaged by the president's comments in the summer, because they were not based on science. They were based on some other thing. And, you know, but they kind of bifurcated this into something where, instead of saying, you know, what's safe to do, let's try to make this work, it was sort of like, well, are you on, which team are you on?
Put
are you
on
the like team? Yeah. Yeah, put your hat on. And like, which, you know, if you are in the blue, if you have a blue hat on, you better say that, you know, nothing is going to open. And if you have a red hat on, you say everything is going to open. And we ended up in a weird situation where this, you know, in this particular dimension, everything has kind of become sort of very politicized. But we've seen it in all of the pieces of COVID. I mean, the idea that somehow there would be a political feeling about wearing a mask.
Yes. Right. Extraordinary.
Insane, right? Insane. It's like, you know, I mean, you could have like a nuance, and I understand part of this was at the beginning, it was sort of unclear whether like masks were good, whatever. Okay, so we like learned more about it. Yes, masks are good. But then to somehow be like, you know, you're impinging on my freedom by asking me to wear a mask in the grocery store. Like, how do we get to that point, you know?
Well, we know,
the other side is true. Right. Yeah. No, exactly. But the other side is true too, right? The people who like when you're on the other side of the street running, And they're like, where's your mask? And she's like, it's 5 o'clock in the morning and I'm outside alone. How can you even see me? It's so dark. You know, so there's a sort of like mask. There's the mask shaming. Yeah. And then somehow we can't just come to a thing which is like, you know, when you're inside or you're around other people, like you should be wearing a mask. And that's just like the thing we should be doing, and get a mask. And if you're outside running far away from other people, like maybe you don't need a mask then. And that's okay.
Yeah, no, it's so let's make a list of what you've learned. And it's a short list because there's so much uncertainty around this, which is fascinating. But one of the things I've learned is that it's probably not a bad idea to wear a mask when inside near other people.
Yes.
When we have friends over on our back porch, they sit 6 to 10 feet away from us. 6 feet, by the way, is a fake magic number, but It's not a bad number. So they sit 6 to 10 feet away from us. We then remove our masks. We sip drinks or eat food together, and it's normal and human, and we like it. And I think the risk is quite low. And wearing a mask when you're closer than that is such a low cost experience. Not zero, does interfere with the human experience a little bit, and I really dislike that. But it seems like a relatively wise thing to do voluntarily. Yeah. I don't think we should mandate it as law, and I think private businesses should be allowed to decide what happens within their spaces, like we do with many other aspects of their lives. So that this has become political is just an incredible barometer of what's wrong with our society right now. But anyway,
yeah, I agree.
Let's talk about the list of things we've learned. So, master one, there's so many conflicting signals in the data about the pandemic. I'm curious what you feel you've learned so far that might possibly be useful the next time, besides that I think you and I are on the same page with masks.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we're increasingly learning there's a huge indoor-outdoor transmission distinction. And we kind of saw that early on from some of the contact tracing stuff. And my guess is we're seeing that now in these sort of surges as things get colder, that, you know, transmission inside is much more efficient than transmission outside.
From the virus's perspective.
From the virus's, yeah. Exactly. From the virus's perspective. You know, I think we're learning that we've learned sort of some things about the age gradient that, you know, it's riskier for older people. And, you know, there's a lot of things that are really unclear about the virus. I mean, there's this aspect of it that most people don't transmit at all, and a small number of people transmit a tremendous amount, right? Like there's this other thing. Everyone was talking a lot about R0 at the beginning, but this other thing is like K, which I think is another epidemiological parameter about kind of how dispersed the amount of spread is per infected person. I think that this virus has like it's a big K or a small K. It's a different K than some other things. And you know, we're sort of seeing that in these kind of like small numbers of people responsible for like larger numbers of infections. But there's just like a lot of things we don't understand.
You know, for me, the most important thing for going ahead, you know, the age gradient thing is obviously true. It was true. I think we knew that from the first cruise ship.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed much. And the age distribution of death has not changed, I think, a whit. You know, it's incredibly stable.
Although the rates have gone down a lot. So we've clearly done much
across
better.
Across all ages. Done,
like in all ages, we've gotten much better at treating the virus, which you would expect to be true. Like they figured out some things, how to do some things better.
But it's still the case that it's more dangerous for older people. And that, which is other than nursing homes where people are extra cautious, which is a good thing, it has not changed the way we've approached the virus. I mean, the school's a perfect example of this. That has not said, well, okay, then we can be more relaxed about. No, we didn't. No. For better, for worse, for whatever social, political, psychological reasons, we've had trouble using that information, I think, effectively. But the other question, which I think going forward is the central question, is this question of so-called lockdown, which is a bad word. And I say it's a bad word because it's ambiguous. It's not precise. Yeah. Lockdown doesn't mean taking precautions. It could mean that in some states it meant be a little more careful. Other states it meant we closed all bars, all restaurants, all gyms, all movie theaters. And countries went from just be a little more careful, like Sweden, to places where they put the army out in the street to make sure that you didn't leave your apartment for a certain length of time. So I think, you know, the biggest question going forward is how much does that matter? And I don't think we know the answer to that. And the people who point to data and say, oh, well, China locked down and they didn't have any cases after whatever, are missing the complexity of the problem. Do you agree with that, or am I being too agnostic there?
No, I think I do agree with that. I think that part of what has been hard about evaluating this is exactly as you say, the sort of like differences in what people meant by lockdown, and also the kind of there's a sort of time horizon question. So, I mean, I think this is going to come up more when we look at like Sweden. We sort of like look back on this, hopefully, from the standpoint of it being over or overish. I think that there would be questions raised about Sweden's approach throughout. And I think that Sweden's approach of sort of like, don't really lock down, let people keep doing kind of more or less doing their stuff initially looked really bad. So their death rates were much higher than, you know, comparable Nordic countries, although not especially not higher relative to some other place in Europe, but certainly relative to like Norway. Norway, Denmark, they looked really bad. Denmark. And that felt, that was like a particularly, seemed like particularly bad if like any moment, you know, in May, we were going to have a vaccine. But once we got to the point where it was like, well, actually, like we don't have, like we're not going to have a vaccine, then, you know, in the current, in this sort of current period, they're seeing much less of a second wave than elsewhere. And I don't know how much of that is herd immunity and how much of it is people learned other ways to prevent it, how much of it is lack of testing. You know, there's a bunch of things going on. But I think that unfortunately learning about which of these things mattered is going to kind of like require a longer time frame, because it's one thing to lock down. You saw this in Israel, you like sort of totally lock down, you drive the cases to zeros, but then as soon as you open back up, like, you know, it's very hard to keep the virus out unless you're like New Zealand. And even there, they couldn't do it.
Yeah, I think that, no, I think the other thing to remark about Sweden that is often forgotten is that they have a different age distribution of their population than some other places. They have different density of their cities. But the appeal to me of treating this like a grown-up might rather than a panicked child is really appealing. That's fantastic. Saying, well, we're not going to ruin the lives of everyone to reduce the death rate to zero, because we can't reduce it to zero. And we realize that these non-health related costs, destroying the businesses and employers of our people and the education of our children, is enormous. And I think, I guess my hope is that we're going to find out whether I'm right about the enormous non-health part of this, and maybe that will help us be more balanced in the future on the health side.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think for me, like a more recent, like in the last couple of weeks, I've been sort of reflecting on the takeaway that as if we think about doing more lockdowns or making, having more restrictions, we cannot, like the hammer approach of just like, you know, shut everything, like the just like sledgehammer approach to this, I think has some very significant downsides, let's put it that way. And I think we need a little bit more of a scalpel approach. And the thing that requires is contact tracing and basically understanding where is the spread happening. Now we're seeing, of course, part of the, like, so Rhode Island is actually doing a pretty good job of contact tracing. And what they're seeing is, and we're also having a lot more cases. And what they're seeing is the cases are from social gatherings, like people's houses, parties, okay. And so, you know, but unfortunately, that's not something the governor has a lot of control over, right? So she doesn't want to close school. She hasn't closed school. She said she's not going to close school. She hasn't closed restaurants and bars. I think part of it is she's just like, look, we are not seeing spread in those places. So closing them is not going to help. Or I don't think it's not likely to help, because what we're seeing is spread at these, you know, parties and gatherings. But it's hard to tell people, you know, you can't have your friends over, although maybe we'll start, you know, sending the National Guard around to your house to find out if you have 23 people in your backyard in your house. But that's, I mean, that's hard. That has some other issues.
Well, they do that in some countries. They have, and they've been more effective. And I think the fundamental question for a free society, which is, again, a conversation we can't have anymore in America for 100 reasons, but a free society says, we don't want to mitigate risk to zero, because that also is very large costs. And we don't want the government telling people when they can have people over. And we understand that when you, my neighbor, has a bunch of people over, you do impose an externality on me. And we ask you culturally to try to keep that in mind. And if you can't, I guess I'm going to try to be more careful when I deal with you. And that's not pleasant. But I want to live in something like a free society. I don't want the government deciding all the risks and having the goal of having zero deaths or zero transmission, because that's not a country I want to live in either.
Yeah. I mean, I think these are, you know, as you say, I think these are very hard conversations to have, because, you know, the sort of other side is like, well, are you just trying to kill old people?
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, now you're a COVID denier,
Emily,
who wants to kill old people.
I am an old person. I'm 66. I'm in the risk group. I'm in the,
you know. You're in a higher risk category than I am. But yeah, you're not an old person.
You're very kind.
You're not an old person.
I appreciate that. Well, let's shift gears. I want to radically shift gears. I want to talk about your other work. I want to talk about parenting. You wrote two very successful and thought-provoking and sane books about risk. And I just want one last thing about COVID to lead us into this is that, you know, you'll look at someone either wearing a mask, not wearing a mask, washing their hands, whatever it is, wearing their mask in their own car, and you go like, oh, that person's ridiculous. Now, then you look at your own life and you realize, you know, I have a bunch of those too. Yeah. I have these things where what I'm doing isn't rational, but it makes me feel good. Like I go to my synagogue, we meet in our parking lot and we're 8-10 feet away from each other when the weather's decent outside. And if somebody sits within 10 feet of me, I move it to 12 feet. It's like, oh, right. Come on, I'm outside. We're all wearing masks. I don't really need to do this, but it makes me feel good, even though I know it's not rational. It's just a little comforting. And I think a lot of us have those weird, anxious, stress-related behaviors that we understand are not necessarily supported by data. So you wrote two books that tried to bring data to bear on an area that people have a lot of emotional issues like we're talking about, parenting and pregnancy. And having written those books and come on to Econ Talk to talk about both of them, and I encourage listeners to go back and listen to those, especially if you're pregnant or about or a parent. I'm curious what, having time has passed, are there things in those books you've learned that aren't true anymore, or the things you'd wish you'd changed? Reflect on that experience.
I mean, writing the books was so the first book came out in 2013, which now is, it just feels like a very long time ago.
The 19th century, wasn't it?
Right, exactly. It's like in COVID time, that actually is actually around the Big Bang.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it has been it has been a long journey, and the book has actually gotten more popular over time, and so it's sort of become like a bigger part of sort of who I am and what I think about. And so actually I just did like quite a large revision. I've sort of revised it a few times, but this fall or this over the pandemic, one of the pandemic projects was to do a pretty big revision in which they let me like revisit things and add a bunch of stuff. And part of what was interesting for me there was to sort of kind of step back into what it was like to be pregnant for the first time. Now, from the standpoint of someone who has like a 9-year-old who, you know, is like a real person who I go to for advice. And then, but just to sort of like, she's really good with people. I'm not that good with people. So usually if I have like a problem, she's like, sort of solves it for me. There were a bunch of things in there that I kind of changed because like some new study came out and they're, you know, mostly pretty mild. Like, can you sleep on your back versus your side? There's been like some new research around that. There was a bunch of new research around labor induction. So I sort of like made a bunch of changes like that. But then I also, the other thing I did a lot of was like softening my tone a little bit. And I think this is something I learned sort of when I wrote the second book, Crib Sheet. It's sort of much more, the message is much more like, you know, look, you got to like figure out what works for you. And it's like a less confrontational book in some ways, and Expecting Better, I think, confrontational maybe is the wrong word. Yeah. So the first book is like a little bit more, I was like having a lot of conflict with my OB, and that comes out a little bit in the yep. book. And I kind of softened, not so much the stuff with the doctors, but just other, like, I don't know. I just like, so I softened a little bit, I think. Mm-hmm. I think I've softened a little as a person. So it was interesting to go back to that and think, huh, you know, like I probably could have used I could have used a different tone in some of these things.
And so you did. You changed some of that. You saw
it. Yeah, I did. I changed some of it. And the other thing that's happened is that like I've become much closer with many doctors. So there actually are a lot of doctors who like the pregnancy book, even though it can be a little negative on medicine. And so I have more like perspective on how they're thinking about some of these choices, which helped me like kind of, I think, both write, like improve the writing so people can have a better interaction with their doctors, but also just made me reflect on, okay, maybe I was like a little bit, maybe I'm actually like the difficult one. I mean, that's definitely true.
Well, after you had that sensitive 9-year-old, that's part of your transformation, right?
I know. She's so sensitive. Man, like socio-emotional learning in the like 2020 fourth grade is really different than in like the 1990 fourth grade, that's for sure.
Yeah, no. Your example of the confrontational tone versus softer, it is interesting to me that, you know, many doctors, they're not good at trade-offs, just not their thing. And you and I are trained to focus on trade-offs. So those conversations can be difficult. I have a friend of mine, I may have mentioned this before on the program, you know, broke his leg in a motorcycle accident. And the doctor who fixed his leg said, "So I hope you've learned your lesson." He said, "What's that?" "Don't ever get on a motorcycle again." Everyone said, "As soon as I get out of here, I'm getting back on my motorcycle." He was an economist. Doctor was a doctor. But I think that's an issue. And for those of us who are more aware of the opportunity cost, as well as the, say, the downside of overdiagnosis, which is not always easily seen by doctors, you can find doctors who share that view. And then you can be softer with them because you get along with them better, I think.
Yeah. No, that is certainly a piece of it.
So you're something, I assume, of a guru to would be especially mothers and fathers as well, people who are planning or have a child. What's that been like for you? Is there a do you get a lot of thank you notes? You get a lot of do you get a lot of emails like, you know, "I'm thinking of having a second glass of wine once a week. Is that pushing it?" Do people treat you like their doctors in that way?
I get a lot of emails. I get many more emails now that I write this newsletter. So at some point, like before the pandemic, I started this newsletter and I write a lot about COVID. It was not the initial intention, but anyway, so I get a lot of email. I get a lot of more email than I used to from that. And yeah, I get sort of like, sometimes people will say thank you. Sometimes people write to complain. And then I get a lot of these like very specific, like I have the following condition. This is how pregnant I am. This is how much dilated I am. Like what do you think? Like, when's the baby going to come?
Is it a boy or a girl?
Exactly. What can you tell me about this? I try to write back to people, but I'm not, like, I get more email than I can reply to, which is a kind of a new thing and actually makes me feel bad because I just want to write back to everybody and be like, "Okay, let me help you with your exact problem." But yeah. I can't do that.
Yeah. I'm curious if your feelings of riskiness in the pandemic, the kind of things we talked about earlier with, you know, that pulling off the Band-Aid anxiety, has it affected the way you think about parenting and the way you think about, the way you talk about risk in your books?
I think it's affected how I think about uncertainty, which is a little bit different than thinking about risk. Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, the most salient and the most scary piece of the pandemic has been the fact that there is so much uncertainty about the risks, right? Or like the sort of like unknown unknowns, that piece, something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know which one it is. But you know, that when I write about things with risks in the book, like even things with where the risk is something very bad, where it's like sort of, it's important to be really careful about it, like co-sleeping or, you know, not that the risks there are so bad, but that the downsides, the things people are worried about are so bad. It's like, we know a lot. So sort of, I find comfort in the idea that like, okay, we can really dig into what we know, and then you're going to have to make the choice. But you know, the choice you're going to make, kind of knowing, at least having some numbers to base this on, and the pandemic, especially early on, even around kids, was just so uncertain that it was very, very difficult to think about how those choices would go. And it made me think a lot more about, you know, the ways in which we have to sometimes move forward and make choices even with uncertainty. And I think it's been a place where we have to make a lot of important decisions, you know, both personal decisions and policy decisions, without being sure. And I think that has led to a lot of decisions which feel cautious, but I think when we may reflect on them later, we may find that they were not as cautious as we thought that they were.
Yeah, they were imprudent despite their seeming prudence. I think the phrase is unknown unknowns. There's the known knowns. There's the things we know about, and we know a lot about them. There are the things that we don't know about, but we know that we don't know them. Then there are the things we don't know about that we don't know. Right. Something like that. But
yes,
anyway.
That's something like that.
I'm writing a book about decision making and the role of data in that, and how hard it is for our minds to consume data. And one of the issues I'm writing about is parenting. And I make the argument that there's really no data of the kind that we normally call data about what it's like to be a parent. there is information. You can read literature. You can watch movies. You can talk to your friends. You can watch your friends. You can babysit. But until you've had a baby or become a parent, it's sort of it's uncharted territory. We had L.A. Paul talking about this, talking about her book, Transformative Experiences, Agnes Callard talking about aspiration. And that's another way we deal with this kind of uncertainty. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. You're a data person. You're also a parent. Have you been surprised at what parenting, you mentioned you're not your daughter. Are you surprised at how parenting has changed in ways that no data, or maybe there is data for you that, yeah, that could help you understand that?
No, I mean, I think I am surprised by being a parent all the time. And I am, particularly as my kids get older, I am surprised at how little, like how little I am able to rely on data to, and how frequently I am surprised at just like what is going on, you know, what my kids are like. The parts of parenting that I find the most difficult and where I am the most unhappy with what I'm doing are the parts where I am like imposing my own like stuff on my kids, yeah, you know, and that's, I find that really hard, that like you sort of have some vision, which is kind of maybe based on the things that you wish that you did, and sort of trying to separate out like, okay, I need to be supportive of the things my kids like. And of course, you know, I'm going to suggest things that I think would be good for them to do, but like sort of how do you learn to recognize like my kid is not exactly like me, and I can't like make them excel at things or just make them do things or make them like things that I like. I find that really hard.
This program's G-rated, but I'll just make a reference to Philip Larkin's poem. It's called This Be the Verse. You can Google it and you can read it. It's related to this. I encourage listeners to check that out. You know, speaking of Agnes Callard, she wrote a very thoughtful piece recently about the challenges in our current culture, which encourage parents to let children become whatever is best for them. And that appeals to me deeply now as an older parent. I wish I'd thought more along those lines and been more, it's very hard. I think we naturally want our children to come out, quote, like us. And I think we probably subconsciously want our children to fix some things that our parents did incorrectly to us, yes, or that, and that's the Larkin poem. And they also, we have a natural urge to extend ourselves into the future through our children. And it's a beautiful thing in many ways. And I think there's this tension between, and the Callard essay, you know, grapples a little with this, between saying, you know, my children are not me. They have to find their own space, their own love, their own desires, their own passions. And at the same time, a family is not just, oh, I raised you like a boarding house. Good luck. Bye. Have a good life. You know, so it's kind of tricky. And these, yeah, times, until about 50 years ago, it was understood, as Agnes points out, that parents were supposed to make their kids turn out like them religiously, culturally, behaviorally. And now it's like, maybe we shouldn't do that. It's like, that's wrong. You have to let your kids find they're just blank slates. Let them explore the world. But that's right. That's not what all kids need either. And not all families.
No, and
need
there's a sort of piece of this, which is like, you know, there are, there's like helping, like sort of if you're, there's helping your kid push through things that are hard to because you know that they will like what comes out on the other end. And I think that sometimes they'd be like, well, I should just like, if they're not enjoying it, they should just quit, you know? But actually like a lot of things as an adult, you know, you like learn to let, and you look back and say, well, I'm really glad I pushed through the hard parts of that because, you know, then there was like a lot of reward. And I think we sometimes, but then there's this piece where it's like, well, actually you don't have to push through everything. Like some things you just don't, that's just not for you. And you know, we shouldn't kind of make them. And I also feel like there's, there's just like a lot of ways in which there are a lot of really good ways in which we're kind of encouraging kids to be, to sort of be sure. who they are and not, you know, like I think back to like when people were left-handed and then they made them write with their right hand, or, you know, like a lot of kids, like a lot of boys wear like a lot of dresses now. And like people are just like, yeah, that's the thing. It's fine. And that was like, that's very different from when I was when I was a kid even. And you know, which was a long time ago, not that long ago. And so, you know, those kind of things seem, that seems great. That seems like really good progress. And, you know, but then I think we also, there's also a piece where you kind of want to help them learn to grow into adults. Like we want to be raising adults. And that doesn't always mean just doing whatever.
Yeah, no, it's such an art, and
it's hard.
There's no, there are no rules. You know, each one's different. It really makes it tricky.
Yes. That's why it's good I only have two. I feel like I'm like already struggling to manage the two. That's how we're done.
Yeah. Well, when you get to three, as a friend of mine said, you're playing shorthanded. You've always, it's the equivalent of having
you
one.
You move from man-to-man to zone defense.
Exactly. Somebody's in the penalty box. Let's close with a... must have been an interesting experience for you. I was watching a cooking show sometime over the summer with my family, and I said, that's Emily Oster. And you were on David Chang's show.
Yeah.
How did that come about, and why were you there?
Right. At some point, somebody wrote to me and was like, hey, you know, I work for this, like, David Chang's Netflix show, Ugly Delicious. Like, you know, David's wife, whose name is Grace, is pregnant. And, you know, like, how about if we have you on and, like, you can, like, you know, go eat sushi with her and you can, like, talk about what it's like to be pregnant and also, like, that it's okay to eat sushi, which is something I talk about in the book. And I was like, all right, yeah. So I, you know, I mean, I don't like, you know, I of course I know who David Chang is, and his wife is very nice. But I just like showed up at this, like, okay, come to this fancy sushi restaurant at this time. And then you just like show up there. And then we ate the sushi. And that was it. And it was like a really weird, I don't know. I'll have these little, so there was like a sort of, the other thing like this was at some point shortly before Crib Sheet came out, Amy Schumer tweeted out Instagrammed the Expecting Better, the pregnancy book, and said that she really liked it. And then I got to be on her podcast. So I got to like go to Amy Schumer's apartment and like, you know, meet her and like record her podcast, which was like a totally weird, like out, just like, that was like a really crazy experience.
Was it as much fun as being on Econ Talk though?
It was very similar. Her podcast has, it's a little more, let's say it's like a little more R-rated than Econ Talk.
Just a little, yeah.
It's just a little bit. Yeah, I'm not gonna share with your listeners the kind of game, the, you know, question game they play on that, but let's just say it's not that similar.
Yeah, I guess not. Well, that's pretty fun. Did that generate any, you ever get any hate mail about like,
oh, sure.
How dare you encourage pregnant women to eat sushi?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I will say nothing, it pales in comparison to the hate mail I get when I say that you should open schools in the face of COVID. But yes, I do get some hate mail about that kind of stuff.
Are you getting a lot of hate mail for the COVID school thing?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
How do you deal with that? Does that bother you?
It does. It really bothers me. Yes, it really bothers me. And I tried to just, my 9-year-old was like, do you have to look at it? And I was like, well, no, not really. And she was like, why don't you just delete it?
She's so wise. So she's growing wiser.
Like a very, very wise person. She was like, she thought about it. And then she was like, do you have to look at that? She's like, when people tweet mean things at you, why don't you just not look at them?
Yeah, it took me a long time
fine.
It took me a while to realize that you can block people on Twitter who are mean to you. It's like, you don't invite them into your house. Why would you let them send you email like that and tweet on you?
You know, I try to just like delete it and move on.
Yeah, but good for you. My guest today has been Emily Oster. Emily, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Always a pleasure. Nice to see you.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.